are far more likely to suffer both vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The study didn't explore why, but researchers suggest because smoking is known to increase blood pressure, inflammation, and the risk of blood clots, it damages pathways to the brain and therefore increases the risk of dementia. Researchers say the findings add to evidence showing what's good for the heart is also good for the brain. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Paul the Octopus has died in Berlin. Paul gained fame when he correctly predicted the outcome of all seven of Germany's games in the World Cup soccer competition. He topped his career with his forecast of Spain's victory over the Netherlands in the finals. Paul was 2.5 years old, which is a normal lifespan according to the aquarium where he lived. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price. Understanding the connections of a complex global economy, T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening, and we're happy to have back on program once again Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. For quite a while now, a few times during the year, Rick is here, and we talk about car care. So if you have some kind of maintenance question, you can call in. Maybe you have a problem, and you're not sure how to solve it. If you call in and tell us, give us the make and the model, and give us the best description of the problem, and Rick will see if he can help you out and suggest a solution. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. We'll take as many callers as we possibly can. And all you have to do is give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. We also have email, so if you'd like to send along your question that way, you can do that. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, we'll take as many questions as we possibly can. Thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Something we've talked about before quite a bit is tire pressure and the fact that it's important that you keep your tires at the recommended pressure. And maybe just to review, I'll ask the question, well, why is that important?
Well, tire pressure, typically what comes to most people's mind is better fuel mileage. The tires are inflated to the correct pressure. The rolling resistance is minimal. As far as tire pressures are concerned, typically the recommended pressure for the vehicle can be found in the driver's door jam. When you open it, there's a sticker there. If it's not there, sometimes it's in the gas cap door. There's a sticker there. And those are the pressures you need to follow. And you check those when the tires are cold. So in other words, first thing before the car is driven, not after it's driven, because after it's driven, there's resistance between the rubber and the road surface, and it generates heat. And, of course, the heat escalates tire pressure. And the other thing that's important about tire pressure is you want maximum life longevity of the tire. If a tire is overinflated, it will kind of like crown in the center. So you'll get excessive wear in the center of the tire. If it's underinflated, it's kind of concave. So you have prominent wear on the inside edge and the outside edge. And when you're checking tire pressures, it's a good thing to just kind of look at the tire. Are there any cracks in the sidewall? If there's cracks in the sidewall, it's usually a good indication the tire's old, it's deteriorating, and it should be replaced. Run your hand across the tire, inside edge to outside edge. Does it feel smooth? If it feels like sawtooth wear, in other words, if you slide your hand to the inside and it's you don't really feel much, but you pull it back towards you and it's kind of ridged, that's an indication there's a problem with the toe. Either car can be towed in or towed out. Toe in is kind of like pigeon-toed. And excessive wear on the inside edge or the outside edge of the wear, which would be smooth wear, is referred to as camber. That's the inclination if you think about the tire as being perpendicular to the ground. If it's angled in at the top, that's referred to as negative camber, and you'd have excessive wear on the inside edge of the tire. positive camber would have smooth excessive wear on the outside edge. And it's, like I said, it's just a visual observation. It doesn't take a lot of time. And if you notice any of those abnormalities, then typically it's an alignment issue. The other thing that people a lot of times associate with alignment problems is a vibration, typically above 45 miles an hour. A vibration that you feel in the steering wheel is usually associated with the front tires, and that would be tire balance. If you feel it in your butt, that's typically the rear tires. The other thing the car should do when you let go of the steering wheel is it should go relatively straight on a flat road. Like if you're in the country and the roads are severely crowned, it's going to go to the right, and that's going to be a normal condition. But on a flat road, it should go straight, and the steering wheel should be straight. So those are kind of a quick summary of...
I'm sure that manufacturers have some number of miles that they think that their tires are going to go. And generally speaking, is there a certain mileage that you should expect to get out of a tire, or does it really vary?
Well, it varies. To get more mileage, you would normally conclude that the tire compound, the rubber, is harder to last longer. And when you go in to buy tires, that's an important consideration. You can buy 30,000-mile tires, 40,000-mile tires. You know, they're rated at, in terms of longevity, mileage, and that's also under the assumption that you keep the rotation of the tires. They should be checked at least every time you do an oil service or every 5,000 miles. And prominent wear typically occurs on the front tires because most of our cars are front-wheel drive today. The weight's up front. As you apply the brakes, there's weight transfer to the front tires. And, of course, when you go around corners, there's excessive wear at times in corners too. So tire rotation is important. When you're buying tires, you need to convey what you're looking for. As you mentioned, okay, I want a tire that's going to – okay, I'm only going to have this car one more year, two more years, so I don't really need to spend the extra money on the higher mileage tire. Are you interested in an all-weather tire? Are you interested in a tire that's extremely quiet? You know, those are things that you need to convey because some tires are quite noisy, the all-season tires. And what makes a tire noisy is the spacing between the tread. And I'm sure everybody's heard big trucks go by on the highway and how loud the tires can be, and that's because of the tire configuration. Mm-hmm. Kind of a self-cleaning type tire, those tend to be extremely noisy.
Well, is there really – I got a call here. I promise I'll get right to them. Is there really that much difference in how a tire will handle, say, ice and snow, so winter conditions, if you have an all-season tire as opposed to what – I don't know what would be – different would be the kind of tire that would be good for, you know, warm temperature, clean, dry roads.
Well, when you visually look at a tire and you look at the tread and the spacing between the tread, meaning the part of the tire that contacts the road surface or the slots, if the slots are real, real narrow, they're going to fill with snow very easily. And then the tire, in essence, becomes bald. Whereas if the slots are wider, they're going to self-clean. In other words, it's less likely to stick in those areas so that you will have traction in the snow. And that's also true in the rain. You know, obviously, as a tire wears, and it wears down to what they refer to as the wear bars, which usually are at about 2/32 of an inch, that's when you definitely need to replace tires.
Okay. Well, other tire questions or other car questions are welcome. Rick Karch is the guest from Rick's Automotive in Champaign, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's somebody to start us off in Rantoul and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah,
hi. I've been having a little trouble with my Ford F-150 lately. I was hoping you could give me at least some insight of where to look. The rear axle somewhere is making a high-pitched squeaking noise, or squealing, I'd say, and it seems to vary with speed, but also it's not all the time. So it's only every now and then, and, you know, if I hit my brakes or hit the gas, sometimes it goes off. So I'm trying to figure out, is this maybe some brake rubbing or something like that, or do I need to go get the bearings replaced, or how can I figure it out? Because it's only when I'm driving. I can't lay under the truck and listen to it, obviously. So any thoughts you have on that, I'd appreciate.
Well, let's define squeal first. Is this a moaning type noise? Or is it does it happen when you step on the brakes? Does it change when you step on the brakes? Does it change when you go through corners?
Well, most commonly, for one, when I reverse, I'll hear it just kind of like, you know, with in pitch in. How do you say that? Like. Repeatedly, sort of, a sort of repeated squeal.
It's so rhythmic?
Yeah, rhythmic, exactly. That's the word I'm looking for.
Okay.
And then other times, I'm not sure if it's exactly the same, but it's about the same squeal, probably the same. But I'll hear it, and then if I just tap the brakes, let go, you know, it'll go away most of the time, and then, you know, come back in 5 minutes or something.
So touching the brake pedal does always make a change.
Yeah, I believe so. But it's not a constant. It's not on all the time. It's only squeaking, you know, usually about the time I get closer to work.
Okay.
You know, and when I first start it up, it tends to be okay.
Did you drive the vehicle today?
Yeah.
Did you hear it today?
Well, actually, I'm still getting to work, so
okay.
I can't tell you yet.
Well, the reason I'm asking the question is if it's associated with the brakes in high humidity, you typically won't hear that noise.
Oh, that could be something. Well, okay. Well, that's something to think
about. But it does sound to be associated with the brakes, if lightly touching the brake pedal makes it go away.
Yeah. So you think if it was the bearings, it would be full-time?
A bearing would be more of a howling or a humming type noise.
Okay.
And
yeah, that's right.
Anytime you have a wheel bearing noise, that usually comes in around 30 to 35 mile an hour. And if you weave to the left and weave to the right, you can make the noise change. The bad wheel bearing will always be louder when you load that side of the car. So in other words, if it's on the left side of the car, when you weave to the right, it'll get louder. When you weave to the left, it'll get quiet. That's a wheel bearing.
Yeah.
That's not what you're describing, I don't believe.
I can agree that it's not a wheel bearing.
Okay.
But I guess if it is the brakes, is this something I need to get fixed? Is this a problem, or is it just sort of an annoyance?
More than likely. How many miles are on the truck?
166,000.
I would probably have them looked at. General ratio of wear on brakes is you'll replace two sets of pads to one set of rears, whether it be shoes or drums. Or pads.
Yeah.
So how many front pads have you replaced?
At least two.
At least two. So it might be time for rears.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you. Let's go on here. We got somebody in Gridley, and they're next. Line four. Hello.
Hello. I have a question in regard to the tire pressure you were talking about. Now, I have probably five or six tire gauges, and I had to replace one last spring, and this is where the issue came up. Now, these are not cheap gauges. They're Milton's and Syracuse gauge, et cetera, et cetera. They're quality gauges. There's a variance of the five or six gauges that I've got from from the one extreme to the other of maybe 4 pounds pressure. How do you know what the actual tire pressure is if you buy a gauge? What standard can you measure that to?
Well, generally the electronic ones are the most accurate. That's one of the problems with tire pressure gauges. the best thing to do is when you take your vehicle in for service and it's has something to do with tires, that you lay your tire pressure gauge or gauges on the passenger seat and you ask them to check them for you. Because typically they'll have an electronic one that's extremely accurate. They're usually within a half a PSI. But what you've described is very common. You pick up five different gauges, you get five different readings. And that would probably be the best way to check them.
Now, the electronic gauges, are those pencil type or dial type?
Well, the face or the display is electronic.
It's like it's digital.
It's a digital display.
Okay, and those are the most accurate.
Correct.
And you would recommend something from possibly Snap-on or some vendor like that?
I think most auto parts stores sell those gauges.
Okay.
Or, of course, you can check online. But the pencil ones are not very accurate. And the other thing you have to remember, too, which is true pretty much of any type of pressure measuring device, let's say if the pressures you're measuring are 30 psi, you want a gauge that reads 0 to 60. So in other words, 30 is about in the middle of the gauge's range. If you bought one that measured from 0 to 200, at 30 it's not going to be very accurate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so that would be what I would look for, and I would encourage you investing in one of the digital display.
Okay, I had another question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
As far as preloading the wheel bearings to a stressful condition, does it make any difference if a vehicle was towed in or towed out? Would that have, if you had a vehicle that was, for whatever reason, slightly towed out instead of towed in, would that pre-stress the bearings more so than if the bearing was towed in?
No.
Even in the condition of an offset rim?
Well, yes. Now, that's different because you get big wheels and you change the load. In other words, you've seen wheels that stick out past the fenders, for example.
Okay, right.
That moves the load point outside of the bearing, so there's more force on the bearing. That's why you need to stay with the same wheel offset so that the load is distributed where it belongs.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you move the load outside, it's like a lever. It puts more stress on the wheel bearing.
This is, on this particular vehicle, this is a standard factory offset rim.
That's what you want.
But if it was towed out or towed in slightly from specifications, would one condition or the other more stress the bearing than
other
condition?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Very good. This morning we're taking questions on car care. Rick Karch is our guest from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. So if you have a problem, you can call in, tell us about it, tell us what kind of car it is and describe the problem, and he'll see if he can help you out. Also, maybe we have other kind of more general questions about maintenance, things you can do to keep your car running longer. Any and all, that's certainly fine. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I actually was looking for a tire gauge recently because of your recommendation to look for one of these electronic digital ones. I went into the auto parts place, and the guy told me something interesting. He said, well, one thing that you need to remember about these is that they don't work very well when they're cold. So I guess to me that says if you're going to get one like that, you can't keep it in your glove box like you used to keep the one that looks like a pen, because then in the wintertime it's not going to work very well. Is that true, you think?
It may be. I really don't know. The one I use that I hook up to normal air hose is digital, And I think it was, I forgot what I paid for it. It was $120, $130. I mean, they get expensive.
Yeah.
But somewhere on the package it should say operating temperature range. But, yeah, that's true. I mean, in an extremely cold environment, any the display may be hard to see.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, and I guess the question is prompted by having now have a new vehicle in our house. And this car, one of the things that it's got is it has some kind of sensor that looks at the tire pressure. Mm-hmm. And if it thinks that tires are low, it'll tell you so. There's an indicator light on the dash. Now, it's not smart enough to know which tire, but it says that one of the tires is low. And then pretty much if you walk around the car, you can tell.
Yeah, just
by looking at it.
Right.
So I've had that experience a couple times, and it all made me think, first of all, about how many times on my old car I was driving around with tires that were too low, and maybe I wasn't really paying attention because the car didn't say, hey, check the tires. But it also made me think, well, even a tire that's in good operating condition, is it going to just naturally lose pressure over time? And if that's true... Like, well, at what sort of a rate is it going to lose pressure?
Well, it shouldn't.
Actually shouldn't. Okay.
Correct. So typically when you see a display like that, if the tires were set at the specified pressure at 90 degrees ambient temperature during the summer, and then you never checked them again until whenever recently the light came on, obviously it's colder, so there's going to be less pressure in the tire.
Oh, okay.
Just because of temperature. Okay. So... the other thing you need to remember about the low tire pressure monitoring devices on a lot of cars, if you walk around the car and you look at all four of them, you say, well, they look fine to me, and you check them and they're all okay. It also monitors the spare on a lot of them. And
okay.
So you can waste a lot of time unless you check the spare. So, and some of them just drive me nuts. The way they monitor pressures and some of the Porsches in particular, they're so precise. I mean, even if it's like 2.5 to 3 pounds, too high, too low, uh-huh. It'll trip the light. And some of the Volkswagens take 20 minutes sometimes of driving to get them to reset. And resetting them is in your owner's manual, the procedure. It typically does not take a special tool. There's usually a button you push, and then you have to drive it for a period of time, and it learns the pressures. A lot of them, you can set a pressure, and you can program that pressure in, and it will learn that pressure, and any deviation from that pressure will turn the low-pressure light on. Some of them do monitor specific corners, but a lot of them don't, as you said.
Yeah. Okay. Well, other calls here. Got a couple of people ready to go back here local, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. I have a question about my car. I have a Nissan Sentra, and I was driving at home this morning in the rain on the highway 57, and that pressure light, blink, 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 blink. It kept blinking. Oh, gosh, maybe it's a couple minutes, and then it went off. Is that normal for that to act like that in the rain, or, you know?
It could be if the signal gets affected, like if you went through a big puddle or something, maybe. Has that happened before, or is this the first time?
No, that's the first time that has happened. I've had it come on, and then I've got the taken it in to get the, you know, get it fixed, you know, get it taken care of.
But all they do is reset the pressures?
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh.
You know, they don't always explain to you what they've done.
Well, you may ask, because if it's always the same tire, there may be a slow leak there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that is, because I just got four new tires, but they rotated the drums. And I'm just concerned if something's going on that I need to go and check.
Well, if they just... So the light came on after the rotation of the tires, or do you think it was associated
with it? Not right after. I've had it done for about 2 weeks.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I would have them check the tire pressures, and like I said, you know, if one of them's low, ask them which one was low.
Uh-huh.
And if it keeps reoccurring, then there's a leak in that tire. I mean, you can still, even though they're new tires, there still can be a leak.
Okay. All I did have some tire work done, you know, the rotation of the tires, and then I had, you know, I had something else, new brake
mm-hmm.
pads or something like that.
Yes.
But, all right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on to someone in Aurora on line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling in regards to my son. He has a 1997 Dodge Neon, and it's getting gas in the oil. And I was just wondering what would be the problem nowadays that would cause that?
Typically, it's running too rich, delivering too much fuel.
But nowadays, there's not really much adjustments on the carburetors, is there?
No, that's going to be fuel injector.
Or fuel injector, I'm sorry, yeah.
Correct. Mm-hmm. There's no check engine light on?
No, and it does work, because I did, you know, you turn the key, you know, and to see if the lights all light up, and mm-hmm. it does light up.
Let me see. Does he do a lot of short driving?
Yes, he does.
Okay. That's usually one of the contributors. You can get gas in the oil. When you say gas in the oil, do you mean when you check the oil, you notice it's overfilled, or you just notice an odor on the dipstick?
Well, I noticed that it was thin, and there's a slight smell of gas. Yeah, and the oil is thinned, you know, thinned out a little bit. I changed it, so.
Mm-hmm. But it's not above the full mark.
No, well, no. No, but his vehicle does use a little bit of oil anyway to begin with, and mm-hmm. so if that's how I know it's the problem is that he wasn't adding oil at, you know, on kind of a regular basis. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, short trips are going to do that. The other thing you might consider is switching to like a high mileage oil.
Mm-hmm.
That'll help quite a bit with oil consumption.
Okay.
As long as the check engine light's not on. And the crankcase ventilation system is working correctly, then I wouldn't be too concerned about it.
Okay, so do you think it might be a bad injector?
Well, usually if you have an injector that's bad, it usually affects idle characteristics. In other words, a lopy idle or a rough idle.
Oh.
Or when you shut the car off and if an injector drips, it will drip raw fuel into the intake manifold, and then when you start the car, it'll run rough, and it will have a gasoline odor.
Hmm.
Do any of those sound familiar?
No, they do not. No.
Okay, then the injectors are probably fine. Now, four times a year, it's recommended that you use a fuel injector cleaner, and that's this little container you simply pour it into the gas tank when you fill it.
If there is, I know there's a whole slug of those different kinds. Is there one that you would recommend on the radio or not?
Tektron.
Tektron. Okay, I'm familiar with that one. I've used that in my pickup.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
No problem. Very good. We're at our midpoint, and we'll just keep on taking calls. Take as many as we can. Rick Karch is here from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's generally here a couple times during the year. We try to do it when the seasons change because, you know, it does make a little difference whether it's hot or whether it's cold or whether there's snow on the ground. But we try to take basic questions about maintenance of cars and also if you have a specific problem. You can call in and talk about it with Rick. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Over to Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both.
Hmm? Morning.
I have a couple questions. Several years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, we had a discussion here. And I asked you about a small diesel engine pickup truck. And you said, no, you didn't think there were any on the market. And I've looked, and I don't think they make one yet, as far as I can tell. And I wondered what your opinion would be, why they wouldn't do that. And also I've noticed that, now, I'm still driving the pickup I asked you about several years ago, and at that time it was old. So now it's real old, okay? And I'm beginning to think more and more about getting a pickup, and the pickup I want, they don't even seem to make. And I'm wondering your opinions on that, too. What I'm looking for is a stick shift. And it's very, very difficult to find stick shift trucks anymore, especially if you want a six-cylinder and a tow package and a small frame, you know, like a Ranger or a Tacoma, they just don't make them. Could you give me an opinion on why they wouldn't want to do that?
Well, most, a lot of it's supply and demand. People
yeah.
just don't ask for that package. But you're right, to buy a basic truck with a manual transmission, no power windows, no air conditioning, no heated seat, no power seats, it's you can't do it.
That's right.
Right, so.
It's just, I don't understand why not. I mean, you know, a working stiff like myself wants a nice, cheap, easy get-around truck that's not being hassled.
The only way you're going to do that is to look for a used one.
An old one, like I've got.
Well, you remember years ago, Volkswagen made a little pickup that had a diesel in it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, every once in a while I see one of those, but not very much anymore.
And to go to my second question, my shop here is fairly close to a railroad line. And I sit over there, and I sit here every now and again, look out, eat my lunch, and I see these trains going by, and every one of these trains has a diesel engine in it, and those diesel engines push a generator that pushes electricity, and they make the train pull enormous amounts of weight with just a diesel engine and a generator and a few electric motors. Why in the world can't General Motors or Detroit come up with the same sort of idea? It seems like it would be fairly clean burning. It's not as good as hydrogen, which is my favorite, but it's fairly clean burning. Small diesel engine, push a electrical generator. You got any decent mechanic would be able to work on all of it. There wouldn't be a whole lot of technology changes. Why don't we use that? And on TV, they advertise that they get 400 and some miles per gallon on some of these things, you know, or per ton or something. And you say, well, if it's that efficient, why don't we use it in regular vehicles?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. I just scratch my head and say, well, why can't we do some of these things that we've already engineered into things? I guess they don't want to do it, do they?
Well, sometimes you wonder about the design of cars, too, when you work on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I think to myself that if you're going to design cars, you need to at least work on cars for at least 6 years, just so you get an idea of some of the engineering. But maybe it has to do with weight. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It does. Maybe we've talked about this before. Maybe I've talked about it when I had people on the show talking about cars. It does seem, well, a little bit odd maybe that diesel passenger vehicles just haven't really caught on in the United States. Now, in Europe, I think there are probably a lot more people driving diesel cars. Mm-hmm. And here, I guess, if you wanted to have a diesel sedan, you know, I guess you could buy a Mercedes, or I think you probably could buy some kind of Volkswagen with a diesel engine, but your choices would be really limited. And I'm not even – I think both of them do make cars. You can get a car with a diesel engine. But I don't – I think that's probably pretty much almost it. And you wonder, well, why is it that the Europeans for a long time have been so much more into diesel and that Americans just – it just has something that's never caught on here.
I think it's just when the diesels first entered the market, they were noisy, they smoked, and when you filled them up, you got that smell on your hands. And I'm really not sure. I mean, you know, they're very efficient. The new ones are extremely quiet. Technology has come a long way with diesels, so... It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Right.
Maybe people just have lost interest in them, so the manufacturers aren't making them as readily available. But you're right. The choices are slim if you want a diesel.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Savoy, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a Toyota Tacoma, and it's less than 3 years old, and suddenly my check engine light went on. And I read the codes, and it refers to something called the air injection system. Are you familiar with that?
Well, it'd be a P code.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And after reading a bit on the internet, I find that this is a common problem in a lot of vehicles, and that the cost of repair can be somewhere around $4,000. Now, why should that system go bad on a relatively new vehicle, and is it likely to recur again? Fortunately, I'm under warranty right now, so I can have it repaired.
Right. Yeah, any 5-year, 50,000-mile emissions, anything that affects the emissions coming out the tailpipe. Is the light flashing or just on?
It's just on.
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely get it in. I don't know where the $4,000 comes from. That seems, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a check engine light cost $4,000.
Well, apparently that each, if both, there's two pumps, and the pumps alone are $1,200, and the, you know, the maintenance above that brings it up to that high cost.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
So you've not had any personal experience with those pumps?
Not getting into the $4,000 mm-hmm. range, no.
What causes them to go bad?
Well, a lot of times it's design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a problem with those, there's typically some kind of recall. It may not be something that you get in the mail.
Yeah.
But when you bring the vehicle in for service, it may apply to you.
Yeah.
But I would definitely get it in as soon as possible and have it addressed.
Yes. And as I understand it, it's simply an emissions problem. It doesn't affect the running of the vehicle.
If the light is flashing, it will affect the running of the vehicle.
Yeah. No, it's just a steady, and it's not yellow. It's white.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thank you. Back here to some local folks. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm looking to buy a car for my son, and he's interested in the Subaru Outbacks. I was thinking of getting a used car. So a used Outback, do you know recommendations on that or similar cars that you would recommend?
I always tell everyone to look at Consumer Reports.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have the little series of circles, and they'll be colored in different fashions. You'll find different years may vary.
Okay.
Overall, the Outback is considered a good car, but I would definitely look at Consumer Reports.
All right.
And then make sure you get a buyer's inspection by someone that you trust.
Okay. And what about similar cars to the Outback? Would you?
Do you want the all-wheel drive? Is that what's
appealing? I think he might, yeah.
Well, front-wheel drive is good, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Hondas, Toyotas are good choices as well.
All right. All right, that's all. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Very good. To line number two, and I think this is Muhammad.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, hi.
I have a 2004 Toyota Prius, and it needs a new battery, 12-volt battery. Can I get that anywhere, or do I have to go to the Toyota dealer?
You're talking about the additional battery.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
No,
not the great big one, but right. The small one.
The one up front. Yeah, you can. You can go anywhere for that.
Okay. Do you have a recommendation?
Interstate.
Pardon me?
Interstate battery.
Interstate. Okay. And then I had another question about how's it going to do in the winter? We have a heavier car, and I don't know whether this is going to work on ice and snow or not.
Well, that's going to be affected by tires.
Okay.
So it shouldn't be an issue.
Okay. Any instruction on how to? Well, it's a front wheel drive, and our other one is rear. So
Well, the front wheel drive is going to be vastly easier to drive in the snow.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks. So why, one of the things you mentioned about the fact that front-wheel drive cars, you get more wear on the tires because that's where the weight
is.
Correct. So because it's got the engine there. But I assume that also that is an advantage because that puts more weight on the tires. And
yes.
To me, more weight means better traction.
Correct.
So are there other reasons other than that front wheel is an advantage over rear wheel if you're driving in winter conditions?
Is the front wheel better?
Yes. So, yes. But is it mostly just the fact that there's more weight on the front?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And maybe also, I don't know, is that a, if you say you have a small car and it's not real heavy, I mean, is that also some reason to think about you might want to have an all-season tire or a tire that's going to do it a little bit better for you in the winter if you have a smaller, lighter car?
That's rear-wheel drive?
I'm thinking even if it's got front-wheel drive.
Well, any of the all-season tires are a good choice.
Okay.
Again, it gets back to the ability of the tires to self-clean. In other words, not get clogged in the tread with snow. Rear-wheel drive, you'll see people put sandbags and they'll put weights and whatever else they can put back there. And a lot of times it doesn't help. It's just you just can't put enough back there. And it takes a little getting used to drive in the snow. But the front-wheel drive, after you've had front-wheel drive, you really are spoiled in terms of traction control. Uh-huh. Yes.
And now mostly if for cars that have rear-wheel drive, mostly is that trucks now that still have rear-wheel drive? Or are there a lot of passenger cars that still have rear-wheel drive?
A lot of passenger cars do. And a lot of them will have what's referred to as traction control. And it limits wheel spin. It also makes the car start out in second gear, so there's less torque. And traction control, you can feel it, and the little light will flash on the dash when the traction control is being activated. And it works extremely well on rear-wheel drive cars.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rick Karch is our guest from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's here several times throughout the year. We talk about cars, maintenance, try to troubleshoot. You had a question, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send an email to well-talk@illinois.edu. Another Champaign person. This is line 3. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry to take a sideways comment from the program a little bit. I just wanted to comment about the person calling regarding the trains. Because it seemed like the impression was that perhaps the cars are blatantly inefficient, and I just wanted to comment that there is some very basic physical laws involved, and that the energy is lost when you either accelerate a mass or when you're working against a force such as air resistance. And, of course, the trains don't have to do much of either because they're either going long stretches at constant speed or because there are a bunch of cars one after the other, they don't have to go nearly against as much air resistance. And when we talk about making the cars efficient, it would probably behoove the speaker to talk about some fundamental limitations, and there's just back-of-the-envelope high school physics calculations that can be done about how much energy it takes to do the certain things that the car does. And then also the fuels, how much energy there is per gallon of fuel. So some fuels are a little bit more effective than others, and of course the price of fuels is variable across the time. So just wanted to mention that, and that there are some basic calculations rather than hand waving that can be done that, oh, maybe our cars could be made 100 times more efficient if the engineers just knew what they were doing in Detroit. That's just not the fact. All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
All right. Well, I guess the one point that is easy to grasp, and maybe people will understand this, is say you're driving on the highway. Once you get the car going, it doesn't take as much energy to keep it going. But if you're doing a lot of driving where you have to start from a complete standstill and you got to get all the weight of that car going, that takes a lot more energy, and that's why it is your gas mileage. If you're driving around town and you're stopping and you're going a little bit and you're stopping again and you're going a little bit and you're stopping, It doesn't matter what kind of car you get, you're going to get the worst mileage that you get in your car, and it's always going to be much better. The more time you can spend, the longer time you can spend at a higher speed and in a higher gear, the more efficient the car is going to be.
Correct. And that's why they're trying to make things lighter and lighter and lighter, exactly as you mentioned. So that's why the Prius, the hybrids do so well, because the engine really isn't running when you're stopping and starting, stopping and starting. That's why they do so much better mileage-wise in town.
Yeah.
For exactly what you said.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's go on to Champaign. Another Champaign person here. Line 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. The Prius 12-volt battery is not available either by Interstate or any other aftermarket outlet. It is still captive to the Toyota dealer. It's a special battery. They call them absorbent glass mats, which similar type are available in the aftermarket, but not that one. It has a smaller battery post and currently comes from the dealer only. And nobody else would have it.
Okay. Well, thanks for correcting me.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right.
And as far I assume also the big battery that those cars have, that you truly, when it comes time to replace that one, you've got to go to the dealer to have
correct
them do it. All right. Let's go to Vermilion County. Line two. Hello.
Good morning. Another question sort of on the same track. I wonder if you could comment on the overall life of a car, of hybrid cars that are coming on. How's the reliability and the cost of repairs? If you keep a car a long time, does it give you the payback that people expect when they are looking at a hybrid?
If you keep it, yes, that's true.
And how about if you buy one that's already got, 60 or 80,000 miles on it?
I don't know much about resale value of vehicles.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about whether they tend to last the way a gasoline engine does if you keep it for the next 60 or 80,000 miles.
Well, I'm not sure. Most of the ones that we work on don't have anywhere near that kind of mileage on them right now. I think, again, Consumer Reports might be a good source of information to what you're referring to. If you look back in terms of the years.
Okay, and in the early years, are they as reliable? Are they more difficult and more costly to repair?
The earlier ones, from what I've read, the battery technology wasn't as good as it is today. In other words, the batteries last a lot longer, and that's one of the big expenses if you have to replace batteries.
Okay, but it's more the battery life rather than other things that might need repairing.
I believe that's true, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have time for, I'm sure, another couple of calls. Someone's calling here, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Anything else that people could be doing, just real basic sort of common sense stuff, along the lines of making sure your tires are properly inflated. Mm-hmm. Things that people can do to try to maximize their mileage. Anything that's really, I'm sure people will come along and say, well, I've got some kind of miracle thing that you can put in your gas tank, and that doesn't work. But really simple things that people can do just to get the best gas mileage they can.
Well, typically mileage, driving habits. How long do you let a car warm up? It's not really necessary to let a car warm up for 5 to 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. You can get in the car, let it run for a little bit of time, and then you can start moving. Driving habits are probably the number one effect on mileage. Normal maintenance in terms of what people think about as a tune-up. Well, it's kind of a misnomer anymore. You're really not tuning up anything. It's typically just replacing air filter on a regular basis as needed. If you drive in the country, dirt environment, it's going to have to be replaced more often, so the engine has to breathe, so a good air filter is important. So those are probably the simplest things that I can think of. But you're right, there's not any magic cure or anything that you can add. There's a lot of devices out there that promote increased mileage. And my take on Lowe's is if they really did work, the manufacturers would use them. Mm-hmm. And they don't. Mm-hmm. So,
back in the day, when Jimmy Carter was president and we were concerned about our use of energy, we had a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, national mm-hmm. speed limit. And the idea was that was supposed to be where you get your optimum gas mileage at that speed, or maybe around that speed. Is that still, roughly speaking, true that now, maybe somewhere between 55 and 65, or maybe around 60, that's where most cars will actually get their best mileage?
Well, I think it's going to vary from manufacturer to manufacturer and vehicle to vehicle. It's your maximum mileage is going to be at a cruising speed where the engine is turning slow as possible to maintain that speed. So if you're in, let's say it was a manual transmission car, and we were in fourth gear turning 4,000 RPM, and we went to fifth gear and we were turning 2,200 RPM, we're obviously going to get better mileage at the lower RPM.
Yeah.
So gear ratios, rear differential ratios, tire sizes, all those things affect mileage as well.
I'm starting to see maybe at least a few more cars that have a sixth gear, and which seems to sort of make a lot of sense, I guess. It, you know, you figure, well, okay, you're going to be on the highway, and you're going to drive for an extended period of time basically at highway speed. So if fifth gear is good, figure, well, okay, if there was a sixth, that would be even better. Will we see more cars with a sixth gear, or is there really very much difference between your performance in fifth and in sixth if you have sixth?
Well, a lot of the automatic transmissions are that way. And typically when they get into that tall gear, it's referred to as overdrive. And some cars will have overdrive button where you can turn it on and turn it off. And you'll notice a significant RPM change. It may be upwards of 400 RPM.
Uh-huh.
And again, back to what we talked about earlier, that if you can get to a steady speed and maintain that speed as low of engine RPM as possible, that's going to be your maximum mileage. So to answer your question, if you're going 55 and you're at, say, 2,000 RPM and you're going 75 and you're at 2,800 RPM, you're not going to get the same mileage.
Yeah. And so that, I guess that's sometimes I wonder, you know, now that in a lot of cars that have automatic transmissions, they give you a tachometer.
Yes.
And sometimes I think, well, what's the point of having a tachometer with a car with automatic transmission? So at least, you know, it doesn't give you any guidance to when you want to shift because you don't shift. But it does tell you something about the performance of the engine.
Yes. Yeah. Cruise control. Use it as much as you can. Never use it in the rain. And never use it in the snow. The reason being that if the vehicle should suddenly lose traction for some reason, whether it be in the rain or in the snow, the cruise control is going to immediately apply throttle. And that's why you should not use cruise control when it's raining or in the snow.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll finish up. Thanks, everybody who called, and thank you for being here. Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's here usually a few times throughout the year to take questions about car maintenance.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
Coming up in the next part of Focus, we'll talk with Jeff Mondek. He's professor of political science at the U of I, but the relationships between personality, our personalities, and our political behavior. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, dry weather is favoring the planting of U.S. winter wheat in the central plains, but more rainfall is needed, especially through Colorado and western Kansas. USDA says that in its first crop production report for the winter wheat crop of the season, says that 47% of the U.S. winter wheat crop is rated in good to excellent condition, and that is down from 62% a year ago. Meanwhile, the U.S. corn and soy harvests remain on a record pace. Yesterday, USDA defended its corn stocks data at the users meeting in Chicago, and we're having conversation this week with our analysts to try to determine what the implications of the conversation were yesterday as we look for the next round of USDA reports coming up on November 9th. Let's go ahead.